In a single day this August, Wall Street just quietly mobilized $500 trillion to buy up the digital real estate of the future. And they did it to, you know, power the $2,000 smartphone you're probably going to buy next year.
Oh, absolutely.
And the video game you'll be playing this weekend. It's wild.
It really is. I mean, it sounds like hyperbole, right? But when you actually trace the money, it is completely literal. The physical bricks of our digital lives are being bought and paid for right now.
Welcome to a brand new deep dive. Today, we are opening up this incredibly dense, just fascinating tech, gaming, and crypto briefing from the Tech & Night Tuesday newsletter.
Yeah, the one dated August 11, 2026.
Exactly. And our mission for you today is to basically cut through the noise. We're going to connect the dots between high finance, cutting-edge consumer hardware, decentralized economies, and, well, those virtual worlds you spend your free time in.
Right, because it's so easy to look at a finance headline or, you know, an Apple leak and a video game patch as completely isolated events. But they aren't.
No, not at all.
They are interconnected components of the exact same digital ecosystem.
And it is completely wild to me how direct that connection actually is. So let's just unpack this. We have to start at the absolute foundation of our digital future, which is the infrastructure.
Like the hardware.
Yeah. Before we can even talk about gadgets or games, we have to look at the sheer brute force computing power required to run them. So on August 10th, 2026... NVIDIA announced what has to be, I mean, one of the most staggering deals in modern tech history.
Oh, without a doubt.
A $500 billion strategic partnership.
With a B, $500 trillion, mobilized over time. And what's really crucial here is who they're partnering with.
Right.
NVIDIA didn't partner with other tech companies. They partnered with six global financial titans. We're talking Apollo, BlackRock, Blackstone, Brookfield.
Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs and KKR.
Just to give you a sense of the scale here, Apollo has something like $1.05 trillion in assets under management.
It's massive.
Blackstone manages over $1.3 trillion. Brookfield has over a trillion. These are the people who own actual physical skyscrapers and shipping lanes, right? Mm-hmm. So why are they suddenly so interested in computer chips?
Well, it's because the language around artificial intelligence has fundamentally shifted. Mm-hmm. I mean, NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang did an interview with CNBC where he explicitly said his company's chips are no longer just technology products.
Right.
He called them investable assets. He compared them directly to commercial real estate or toll roads.
Wow.
And then Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, echoed that exactly. He called AI infrastructure the physical asset of the 21st century.
I love that toll road analogy because it just reminds me so much of the 19th century railroad boom.
Oh, that's a great comparison.
Right. Back then, Wall Street realized that the real generational wealth wasn't in building the trains themselves. Like, the trains are the AI software in this scenario.
Right, the applications.
Exactly. The real money was in laying the tracks and charging everyone to use them. But here's my question for you. Wall Street getting involved at a $500 trillion scale. Does this corporatization of AI compute actually help the little guy?
That's the big question.
Or does this just hand the keys to the future directly over to massive asset managers?
It's a totally valid concern. But when you look at how this business model actually works, it paradoxically helps the little guy.
Really? How so?
Because they're setting these platforms up to operate very similarly to REITs. Or real estate investment trusts.
Okay, so like when investors buy shares in a portfolio of apartment buildings and they earn revenue from the rent.
Exactly. In this case, the financial partners are setting up these independent platforms, they're calling them AI factories, and they're packed with NVIDIA technology.
Got it.
So investors buy shares in that infrastructure, and the revenue comes from leasing that computing power out to AI companies. So to answer your question, this actually lowers the barrier to entry significantly.
Wait, how does it lower it? It sounds like they're just monopolizing all the hardware.
Well, think about the previous paradigm. Like a year or two ago, if you were a scrappy startup and you wanted to build a new AI model, you needed to raise hundreds of millions of dollars up front just to purchase the graphics processing units, the GPUs.
Right, because you had to own the servers.
Exactly. It was a massive bottleneck. The demand for AI training vastly exceeded the available chips. But with this financing mechanism, it democratizes access. A startup no longer needs to buy the hardware outright.
Oh, they just rent it.
They just lease cutting-edge computing capacity from these AI factories on flexible terms.
Hmm. So Wall Street fronts the $500 trillion to build the massive warehouse-size AI platforms, and the startups just rent the space.
Exactly.
It literally is digital real estate. Okay, so Wall Street is building these massive digital factories, but how does that translate to us? Because all of that warehouse-sized power, eventually, it shrinks down into our hands.
It does.
Which brings us to August 2026's massive, completely unexpected leak from the luxury customizer brand Caviar. They basically detailed the entire September Apple lineup.
Yeah, and this leak caused an absolute stir in the tech world. Not even because of the design necessarily, but because of the sheer density of the engineering they're trying to pull off here.
Right. I saw this leak, and what stood out to me wasn't just the camera upgrades or the screen size, it was the sheer panic over energy and heat.
Oh, the thermals are crazy.
They are putting what they call an A20 Pro chip in the iPhone 18 Pro, and it's built on a 2-nanometer process. Why is a 2-nanometer chip such a massive leap?
So when we talk about nanometers in chip manufacturing, we're talking about the size of the transistors.
Okay.
A transistor is essentially a microscopic on-off switch. Smaller transistors mean you can pack way more of them into the exact same space.
Right, which makes it faster.
It vastly increases computational power, but more importantly, it simultaneously reduces the distance electrons have to travel.
Meaning less energy is wasted.
Yep.
Exactly. The result is up to 30% more energy efficiency. But cramming that much processing power into a tiny space creates a massive physics problem.
Heat.
Yep, heat.
Which explains so much of the physical design that leaked here. To manage that hyperdense chip, Apple is supposedly cramming in a massive 5100 to 5200 milliamp hour battery.
That's huge for an iPhone.
It is. And to fit a battery that large without making the phone weigh like a literal brick, they've had to switch to a slightly thicker but much lighter titanium body.
Right.
Plus, iOS 20 is reportedly shipping with 12 new features, including entirely new advanced cooling management software just to keep the thing from melting in your hand.
It really is a masterclass in thermal dynamics.
Yeah.
But the leak didn't stop at the Pro models, right? Caviar also leaked the details on the iPhone Ultra, which is Apple's very first foldable phone.
And the specs on this are wild. You've
Yeah.
got a 5.3-inch external display for quick tasks and a 7.8-inch internal OLED screen with 120 Hz refresh rate when you open it up.
Beautiful displays.
Yeah, protected by ceramic shield on the outside and ultra-thin glass on the inside. But the kicker, the engineering marvel here, is a completely crease-free hinge design.
Which has been, that's the holy grail of the foldable market for years.
It really has. But I have to push back on the reality of actually buying this thing. The leak suggests the Ultra is going to cost over $2,000.
Yeah, it's not cheap.
And Caviar's luxury customized versions, the ones dripping in gold or whatever they do, start at $10,060. I mean, are we hitting a point of diminishing returns here for the average person?
It's a fair question.
With $2,000 price tags, are smartphones transitioning from being essential utility tools into pure status symbol luxury items? Like, are they becoming a Rolex that makes phone calls?
It certainly looks that way on the surface, but if you connect this to the bigger picture of the smartphone industry, it actually makes a lot of strategic sense.
Okay, help.
Well, the foldable market has been stuck in this early adopter phase for years. Competitors like Samsung have been iterating. They've been trying to perfect the hinge, but it hasn't completely taken over the mainstream.
Right, it still feels a bit experimental, like you're testing it for them.
Exactly. But if Apple successfully launches a truly crease-free foldable, it's a massive industry disruptor. The Ultra isn't meant to be the phone for everyone. It's a statement piece.
Oh, I see.
It forces competitors to accelerate their own research and development. Apple is intentionally using that $2,000 price point to pull the foldable market out of that experimental niche and firmly establish it in the mainstream premium segment.
They're setting the new ceiling. They're basically saying this is what top-tier technology costs now.
Precisely. And weighing in at just around 280 grams, it's a premium experience through and through.
Right. Okay, so if hyperdense hardware is the engine, digital currency is the fuel. Let's transition to how value is actually moving through these next-generation networks.
Let's do it.
Let's look at the crypto market in August 2026, because Bitcoin had a wild start to the month, hitting a peak of $65,800.
Yeah, which gave it a $1.3 trillion market cap and about 58.5% market dominance.
And what's fascinating is looking at why it hit that peak. The macroeconomic drivers behind this are just a textbook example of how intertwined crypto has become with traditional legacy finance.
Absolutely.
It started with weak U.S. non-farm payrolls.
Right. So let's break that down for a second.
Please do.
Non-farm payrolls is basically employment data. Weak payrolls mean fewer jobs were added than expected.
Okay.
When employment data is weak, the market expects the Federal Reserve to step in and cut interest rates to stimulate the economy.
Right. And lower interest rates mean borrowing money is cheaper, so investors get a little braver and push their cash toward riskier assets, like Bitcoin.
That is the exact mechanism. Yeah. You also had rising geopolitical tensions in the Strait of Hormuz, which historically drives investors to seek out safe haven assets.
Oh.
Combine those macro factors with a staggering $854 million flowing directly into Bitcoin ETFs over just 5 trading days.
Over 5 days.
Yeah, just 5 days. You're the perfect storm for a massive price surge. Though it is worth noting that analysts are seeing a very tight technical resistance right around that $68,000 to $70,000 range.
So Bitcoin is basically acting like a macroeconomic sponge, just absorbing all this traditional market anxiety and ETF money.
Pretty much.
But then you look at Ripple, and they're having a completely different kind of month. Ripple launched a stablecoin, meaning a token pegged directly to the US dollar so the price doesn't fluctuate, called RLUSD on the XRP ledger.
Right.
And it is absolutely dominating.
The on-chain data for the ledger is staggering right now. I mean, right. Over 30 days, they processed $4.28 billion in stablecoin transfers. That's a 10.8% increase.
That's huge.
And on August 6th alone, they minted over 811,000 new units of their stablecoin, giving it almost 90% dominance of the network's stablecoin pool.
Wow. And they're partnering with traditional firms too, right?
Yeah, they have a massive strategic partnership with Japan's SBI Group to push this forward.
But here's where it gets incredibly strange. It's what the newsletter explicitly calls the XRPL paradox.
Yes.
The network is processing billions of dollars. The stablecoin is booming. And yet XRP, which is Ripple's native token, dropped over 43% year to date.
It's wild.
Let me use an analogy here to see if I have this right. It feels like a city building a wildly successful, heavily trafficked highway. The highway is the network, and the stablecoins are the cars packed bumper to bumper.
Right, lots of traffic.
But the company's stock, XRP, is tanking because the tolls to use that highway are just way too cheap to generate any meaningful profit. Why on earth would Ripple pivot so hard into stablecoins if it completely cannibalizes the perceived value of their own native token?
It is the ultimate question of utility versus speculation. And your highway analogy is perfect. The XRPL paradox happens precisely because the ledger's transaction fees are extremely low by design.
Okay.
When fees are that low, very little XRP gets burned.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on. Gets burned. Let me make sure we're totally clear on this. You mean because the network isn't literally destroying enough tokens to pay for those transaction fees? The overall supply of XRP stays too high.
Yes.
And because supply is high, the price drops.
Exactly. In crypto economics, destroying or burning tokens creates deflationary pressure. It makes the remaining tokens more rare, which usually drives the price up.
Right.
But because XRPL is so cheap to use, that deflationary pressure barely exists. Add in the fact that Ripple does regular escrow releases of XRP, which puts more tokens into circulation, and you get massive downward pressure on the price.
It sounds like they are shooting themselves in the foot.
In the short term, maybe.
Yeah.
But Ripple's pivot to stablecoins is actually a brilliant long-term strategic shift.
How so?
They are moving away from trying to push a highly volatile speculative token, and instead they're trying to build a complete standard-setting financial ecosystem.
Because you can't run a real business on a currency that drops 40% in a few months.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Stablecoins offer the stability required for real-world commerce. If you are a massive corporation doing daily cross-border payments or international settlements, you need absolute certainty of value.
Makes sense.
Ripple wants to establish their stablecoin as the industry standard for fast, cheap transactions. They believe that if they increase the network's overall utility and institutional adoption, if they get the whole world driving on their highway, the value of XRP, which acts as a bridge asset between different fiat currencies, will eventually appreciate naturally.
So they are playing the long game, building the massive, unshakable infrastructure first and trusting that the value will follow once the world relies on it.
Which perfectly mirrors what Wall Street is doing with those $500 billion AI factories.
Exactly. Which brings us to the final piece of this puzzle. We have Wall Street funding warehouse-size AI compute. We have Apple figuring out the physics of cramming that power into titanium bodies in our pockets.
We have Ripple and Bitcoin building the financial rails to move billions of dollars. So, Where is all of this energy actually going? What are we using it for?
The answer for millions of people is, well, virtual worlds. We're spending our time in massive digital ecosystems, and those ecosystems are having to evolve incredibly aggressively just to retain our attention.
Let's talk about gaming, starting with Diablo 4. Blizzard announced their first major expansion, Vessel of Hatred, launching October 8th, 2026, for $39.99.
Yeah, and this is a big deal for the franchise.
It takes players into this jungle setting, Nahantu, and introduces the Spiritborn class, which is the first entirely new character class in the Diablo series in years.
And what's fascinating from a design perspective isn't just the aesthetic of the class, it's the underlying mechanics.
Yeah.
The Spiritborn class is built entirely around extreme flexibility.
Right.
Players harness four different spirit guardians. You have a jaguar for speed and bleed damage, a gorilla for strength and defense, an eagle for precision and ranged attacks, and a centipede for poison and damage over time.
And the hook is that players can mix and match these guardians to create highly customized hybrid playstyles.
Exactly. Plus new systems like mercenaries and paragon glyphs.
Right. And they're also adding a massive new endgame activity called the Kuarast Undercity. But before we get into the psychology of why they are adding that, let's look at the other major gaming update from the newsletter, because the parallel is striking.
It really is.
Zenless Zone Zero, a totally different game from a developer called Hoyoverse, released a massive version 3.1 update called The Long Goodbye to celebrate its second anniversary on July 29th, 2026.
And they went incredibly big. They introduced something called the Lumiflux element via a new Void Hunter character named Rimmel. Her banner runs until September 8th, by the way.
Plus a new character named Sigrid.
Right. And in a game based entirely on elemental reactions, this is the first fundamentally new element they've added to the game in 2 years.
They also gave players unprecedented rewards. Mm-hmm. In the world of gacha games, where players normally have to spend real-world money for a random slot machine chance at getting top-tier characters, Zenless Zone Zero just straight up gave everyone a free S-rank selector.
Which is unheard of for them.
Basically letting players just pick a top-tier character for free. Oh, and 5 summer swimsuit costumes, naturally.
Naturally.
But crucially, just like Diablo, they introduced a brand new permanent endgame mode called Tactical Assault.
Do you see the pattern emerging between these two updates?
That is exactly what I want to point out. You have two completely different games. One is a dark fantasy action RPG from Blizzard, and the other is a hyper-stylized gacha action game from Hoyoverse.
Right.
Yet both of them are using these massive updates to specifically fix criticisms of their base game endgame loops. Diablo is leaning heavily into the Kuarast Undercity, and Zenless is leaning into Tactical Assault.
Yeah, they're both addressing the endgame.
Why does the entire live service gaming industry seem to rely on fixing repetitiveness years later? Why not just launch with varied endgame content on day one?
It comes down to the brutal economics of game development and the reality of player psychology.
How so?
When a massive base game launches, developers have to focus the vast majority of their resources on the initial leveling journey, the core combat mechanics, and the cinematic story. That is the spectacle that gets people to buy the game or download it on day one.
Right, the shiny marketing material. You need that to get them in the door.
Exactly. But the end game, what players do after the story is over, is what keeps a live service game profitable for years. And the reality is, over time, any end game gets repetitive, no matter how much money you throw at it.
That's fair.
Players are incredibly smart. They will always solve a game. They figure out the most mathematically efficient way to play, which the community calls the meta.
Oh, I know the meta all too well. It is so frustrating when you just want to play casually and you jump online and the hardcore players have completely optimized all the fun out of the game.
Oh, yeah.
They've crunched the numbers. And if you aren't playing the exact right build, you're just left behind.
Exactly. And when a game gets solved like that, it gets boring. Player retention drops. To keep a live service game alive, developers have to fundamentally break that meta. They can't just add more of the same enemies. They have to introduce completely new variables.
Ah, which is why Diablo didn't just add a new sword. They added a highly flexible four guardian system with the Spiritborn.
Right.
And why Zenless didn't just add a new character. They added the Lumiflux element, which changes the fundamental reaction mechanics.
Exactly. It forces players to relearn the rules of the game. It shakes up the established order. It rewards your hardcore players by giving them brand new puzzles to optimize and solve, and that excitement naturally brings lapsed players back to see what's changed.
And the generosity.
Like giving away a free S-rank character.
Yeah.
That's just the honey to get them back in the door so they actually experience the new mechanics.
So, to bring this entire deep dive full circle, look at the incredible narrative through line we've just traced here.
It's quite a journey.
We started with Wall Street titans quietly pouring half a trillion dollars into the massive physical bricks of AI compute infrastructure. We saw how the brutal physics of that cutting-edge technology forces Apple to build titanium bodies and advanced cooling just to put a 2-nanometer chip in our pockets.
Which is still mind-blowing.
We navigated the paradoxical world of digital money, where Ripple is sacrificing short-term token prices to build an unshakable stablecoin highway for global commerce. And finally, we ended up in the virtual jungles and tactical arenas of our favorite video games, which are desperately using all of that computing power and design ingenuity just to break the meta and keep our attention.
It really is a powerful reminder. A finance deal in New York, a phone leak from a customizer, a crypto chart, a video game patch. They're not isolated events.
Not at all.
They're all deeply interconnected gears turning the exact same digital machine that you and I interact with every single day.
Which leaves us with a final, lingering thought for you to chew on as you go about your week. Let's go all the way back to that NVIDIA segment. If AI computing power is truly the real estate of the 21st century, and a handful of legacy Wall Street asset managers, the BlackRocks and Blackstones of the world, are the ones funding and owning these massive AI factories.
Right.
What happens to the early promise of a decentralized internet?
It's the ultimate question. Because even in the invisible, weightless digital world, someone still owns the bricks.
Exactly. When the digital land runs out or becomes entirely corporatized, who will be your ultimate digital landlord? And what rent will they charge for you just to participate in the future? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.